From The Recount, I'm Rena Ninen, and you're listening to The Recount Daily Pod. Today's Tuesday, September 14th.
Think about a parent who has to make a gut-wrenching decision to send a child on an evacuation flight that they are not able to board themselves. As a parent myself, I mean, that's a horrible decision that I can't imagine making.
That was J.C. Hendrickson of the International Rescue Committee talking about the Afghan refugee situation. We're going to get into that a little later, but first, your morning headlines. We begin in Afghanistan, where top UN officials warned that millions of people could run out of food before the arrival of winter. They said that 1 million children could die if their immediate needs are not met. The UN said it needs $606 million in emergency funds to address the crisis, but admitted that the money is not enough. They also need manpower. International aid workers fled the country during the Taliban takeover, and until the Taliban are willing to provide assurances that aid workers can operate safely, they are not coming back. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres was asked if giving aid to a country that has human rights issues was a good idea.
Humanitarian aid abides by humanitarian principles. Humanitarian aid doesn't abide by political strategies.
Next to COVID, a new poll from Politico and Morning Consult shows that a majority of Americans, 58%, support Biden's vaccine mandate for companies with over 100 employees. That policy was announced last week. Poll respondents remain divided on their perceived political ideologies behind the mandate. 46% say the mandates protect the rights of Americans, while 41% say the mandate violates those rights. Several GOP leaders are promising to fight back. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis was the first to announce that Florida cities and counties that require employees to get vaccinated will be fined $5,000 per infraction. The defiant declaration comes as the latest CDC data for Florida was released. Florida reported over 33,000 new COVID cases and 975 deaths since just last Friday. Apple issued an urgent update for all iPhones to patch a vulnerability discovered by researchers in July. The vulnerability, used as early as February, installed surveillance software called Pegasus on the phones without the user ever clicking a link. The program was created by Israeli firm NSO Group and allegedly was used to spy on journalists and human rights activists in several countries. And now to our daily deep dive. The Taliban's rapid overtake of power in Afghanistan precipitated an exodus like none ever before. It was the largest airlift evacuation in U.S. history, with many tens of thousands of refugees now facing an uncertain future. The International Rescue Committee is one of several U.S. nonprofits helping to resettle the refugees. So what are the biggest challenges they face right now? J.C. Hendrickson, Senior Director of Policy and Advocacy for Resettlement, Asylum, and Integration, joins me now to explain. Hey, J.C., welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. You know, it's such a heartbreaking situation, and you look at just the lengths it's taken to get Afghan refugees approved and out of the country. From your bird's eye view, what do you see right now as the biggest issues facing the resettlement of these Afghan refugees?
Afghanistan has a large humanitarian crisis, one of the largest in the world. There are about 18.4 million people in Afghanistan in need of humanitarian assistance. That's about half of the country. People that have been internally displaced in Afghanistan just this year alone is at about 550,000. So this is a region of the world that is in great need of humanitarian assistance in country. And then, as you said, robust pathways for people who feel that they need to leave the country to get to safety.
And there are so many people who left so quickly, they couldn't grab their passports. The U.S. didn't have the infrastructure to actually process these special immigrant visas so quickly. If folks don't have the paperwork, how do you process them? How do you ensure they are who they are and that they don't pose a security threat to the U.S.?
There are tens of thousands of people when the U.S. began this process that were at some stage of the SIV process. So the evacuations that we have seen over the last several weeks until August 31st, in large part, were people who had already cleared the security vetting stage of the process. The special immigrant visa process is a lengthy one. There are 14 steps to it, and it has been plagued by backlogs for years. And what we saw, I think, in the last several weeks is really the culmination of all of those backlogs kind of brought to a head. But in terms of security, the people who were evacuated have cleared those checks. The U.S. government knows who they are. And they were brought to facilities in the U.S. to really finish the last stages of processing.
When you look at the numbers, you know, based on the research I have here, since mid-August, the U.S. has admitted approximately 24,000 of the Afghans that had evacuated from Kabul this summer ahead of the withdrawal. Walk me through how the resettlement process happens.
So the International Rescue Committee, we have a presence in more than 20 U.S. cities across the United States, and we help people find housing, find a job, help people get on their feet when they arrive in their new home. Of course, that's looked a little bit different during the Afghanistan relocation effort. And our help now has started on government facilities, where we help people finish the last bit of paperwork needed and then move them to those resettlement services. That effort is something that we haven't seen in at least the last 20 years in the United States. We're one of 9 resettlement agencies who are participating in sort of both aspects of that process. It's a lot of people, but we're all hands on deck and moving our staff around to help process people through.
So, JC, I want to ask you about a status known as parole. What does that mean and what is that?
Parole is an emergency status that is granted by the Department of Homeland Security, and it's actually very rarely used. And what it allows for is quick access to U.S. territory in an emergency setting. Those people are in the SIV process already. It's just a means to get people to the country as quickly as possible. But some of the pitfalls of parole are that there's not necessarily a path to permanent residency. And the typical benefits that somebody who enters through the refugee resettlement program would receive are not granted to people who enter on parole. So some of those immediate financial assistance programs are not granted. So there are some pitfalls to using the parole process here.
And I should mention, SIV stands for Special Immigrant Visa. You know, I remember when all the evacuations were happening in August, I was hearing some are being sent to Qatar, some are being sent to Italy. And I thought, wow, it's great, all these nations are helping. But then you come to realize they're actually being sent to U.S. military bases in those countries. Are there other countries that are helping take in these refugees, or is the burden largely on the U.S.?
There have been efforts by allies in the region and in Europe to help. This has really been a global community effort. And it's important, though, that those efforts not come to a halt because the evacuation efforts have ended. It's as important as ever to drive aid to trusted partners on the ground in Afghanistan. There are more than 150 NGOs who operate in Afghanistan. And it's really the responsibility of the United States and other wealthy nations to continue to drive aid to those organizations in this critical time. But it's also the responsibility of the U.S. and Western nations to continue to open up pathways for resettlement to people who really need it and make sure that some of the policy issues that cause delays are resolved and that robust resettlement is allowed in Europe and in the United States.
And as I mentioned at the top, I mean, we have not seen resettlement and evacuations like this before in U.S. history to this extent. What are some of the infrastructure issues that you're facing in dealing with these numbers?
Well, the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program has had an infrastructure that was decimated over the last 4 years based on intentional policy decisions. So before the Afghanistan evacuation effort, we were already in the process of scaling back up and returning to a robust level. U.S. Refugee Resettlement Program is a public-private partnership between the U.S. government and the 9 resettlement agencies that it contracts with, including the IRC. And the best way for the government to create a robust refugee resettlement program is to set ambitious admissions goals. So that's why we are calling on the administration this year to set a refugee admissions goal of 200,000 people, which will unlock critical resources for the resettlement agencies and allow us to staff up and welcome.
We've got to take a quick break, but we'll be right back with JC Hendrickson from the International Rescue Committee on the Recount Daily Pod. Welcome back to the Recount Daily Pod, a podcast from the Recount and iHeartRadio. I'm here with JC Hendrickson from the International Rescue Committee. We're talking about the challenges in resettling tens of thousands of Afghan refugees after the U.S. pullout. When you talk about the cutbacks, I just want to explain to our listeners, refugees were about 85,000 coming into the country the last year of the Obama administration. And under President Trump, they went down to 15,000. What kind of impact does that have on an organization like yours when it goes down from 85,000 to 15,000?
Well, and it was 4 years of consecutive historic lows. But it wasn't just the cap, which is important, but it was also discriminatory bars were put on refugee sort of allocation categories from around the world, particularly impacting Muslim refugees and refugees of color. So the cap and the discriminatory sort of regulations together did real harm to the resettlement infrastructure in the U.S.
JC, I can't imagine, it's a Herculean achievement in and of itself, doing what you guys are doing. I can't imagine undertaking this in the middle of a pandemic. And I've also heard there's been a measles outbreak for some of the refugees. How do you keep everyone safe from a health perspective?
Well, we have rigorous testing protocols in place. And of course, people who are part of this process are vaccinated. Some are vaccinated before they board planes and come to the U.S. Some are vaccinated on the bases. There is testing that happens before flights and then after arrival. It's a really rigorous setup. And I think it really shows, when we think about refugee resettlement in a public health conscious way, what we're able to do. But of course, sometimes people get sick, and then there's a protocol in place for quarantine and things like that.
So when you look at this, there have been a lot of reports of unaccompanied minors. How many do you anticipate are part of this group? And are there some of these Afghan refugees who might potentially be up for adoption?
Yeah, it's of course heartbreaking to see that there are some unaccompanied minors that are a part of this group. And I think, to me, that shows why it's so important to have robust resettlement pathways. Think about a parent who has to make a gut-wrenching decision to send a child on an evacuation flight that they are not able to board themselves. As a parent myself, I mean, that's a horrible decision that I can't imagine making. And that's why it's so important that we have refugee resettlement programs that don't call for people to make decisions like that. One of the programs that was created in light of the Afghanistan evacuation was called a P2 program, which, in addition to the SIV program, allows people affiliated with the U.S., you know, a kind of a pathway to resettle. But that program doesn't currently take into account family dynamics in Afghanistan. So you have people who are making decisions to stay because they can't bring their families with them, or having to send some family members and leave others behind. And that's not acceptable. And I think we can do better than that.
I can't imagine the trauma and the mental health of these refugees. What are you doing to help them on that standpoint?
Well, counseling services are available as part of the processing, both on the military bases and when people enter the refugee resettlement program and talk to resettlement agencies off bases. There are both faith-based and secular refugee resettlement agencies that have services that sort of match those different areas. But you're right, this is a traumatic event. And I think it's important that when engaging with refugees that have gone through an experience like this, that we keep that front and center. These are people who don't owe anything to the United States. This was the bare minimum that we could do. So I think it's really important to approach this situation with empathy.
We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back with JC Hendrickson from the International Rescue Committee on the Recount Daily Pod. Welcome back to the Recount Daily Pod, a podcast from The Recount and iHeartRadio. I'm here with JC Hendrickson from the International Rescue Committee, and we're talking about the challenges in resettling tens of thousands of Afghan refugees after the U.S. pullout. You're dealing with a very large Muslim population of refugees coming to a largely Christian country. You know, there are cultural protocols as well. Women might not necessarily shake a man's hand or feel comfortable with a male doctor. How do you help them with the cultural transition?
Cultural orientation services, language access, are all part of the basket of services that refugee resettlement agencies provide. But similar to the trauma that I think we need to keep front and center when we're talking about Afghan refugees, but also creating policy on how best to welcome people, we also need to keep in mind some of these cultural differences and use a little grace and give people the time and the space to learn about their new country and maybe take some time to understand the culture that they bring with them. We know people who processed through the refugee resettlement program, 57% of them are small business owners. We know that people, particularly in the health field, are huge percentages of the refugee community in the United States. People who come to the U.S., you know, work hard and do what they can to provide for their families. But we just need to give them some time to adjust and recognize the difficult circumstances by which they came.
Are there parts of the U.S. that a large swath of these Afghan refugees will be settled? Where are they largely moving to?
Well, it kind of depends. Some people come to the U.S. with existing ties, family, friends who either came before them or were U.S.-based to begin with. For those who don't, you know, housing is a really important part of the resettlement process. And it's determined by where there's availability, where communities are set up to welcome refugees. But I think to that latter point, it's really important and heartening to see how much widespread support there has been from communities across the country, kind of spanning the geography and the politics of our nation. I mean, we've seen 37 governors welcome refugees with statements of support, and 19 of them are Republican, which I think is tremendous in this partisan time that we're living in. In addition to that, the U.S. Conference of Mayors, which is the largest gathering of mayors in the country, passed a resolution a few weeks ago indicating their support for Afghan refugees. So we're seeing that support from governors to mayors and across the nation. And that's really what we want to see, is as many communities welcoming refugees as possible.
I want to ask you about the tens of thousands of Afghans who were left behind during the evacuations. Is IRC involved with helping to get them out, or is it just too little too late at this point?
Well, we firmly believe that anybody who's still in Afghanistan who feels like they're not safe and needs to leave need to have open pathways to be able to do that. So whether that's leaving from the airport or across a land border, you know, those systems need to be in place that allow people who feel like they need to leave to leave. And whether that's through the SIV program, the P2 program, you know, humanitarian parole, we need to have robust resettlement systems in the U.S. so that people in Afghanistan that want to leave know what their options are. To answer your question, the end of August cannot be the end of people who want to leave Afghanistan leaving. And it's really the responsibility of the U.S. to make sure that those people have adequate pathways to protection.
I know people don't want to admit this. I've spent years in a war zone and in the Middle East, but sometimes you've got to cut deals with bad people. It's not a black or white situation. There are a lot of shades of gray. Do you see an organization like IRC working with the Taliban, or do you think that there's just no chance of that ever happening?
Well, the IRC's role in Afghanistan is to deliver humanitarian assistance to people who need it in Afghanistan. And we've been in Afghanistan since the late 80s, in and out of several conflicts, in and out of different control of the government. And it's something that needs to be managed delicately. But the question on our end is the focus on delivering aid to people who need it, and are we able to deliver that aid? That's going to be our concern first and foremost. But yes, I mean, we operate in more than 40 countries across the world. And in the countries where we deliver humanitarian aid are countries that typically face conflict. Those are factors that we have to consider when delivering aid to people.
JC Hendrickson with the International Rescue Committee. JC, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And now to the look ahead. Here's what else we're watching today. Tropical Storm Nicholas is expected to hit Texas and Louisiana today, bringing with it up to 16 inches of rain. Louisiana declared a state of emergency on Sunday in anticipation of the storm. Today is the final day of voting in California's gubernatorial recall election. Voting results will determine whether Gavin Newsom stays in office or not. If voted out, the next governor will be determined from the same ballot. Though Newsom is expected to win, he has plenty of opponents eyeing his seat. Hopefuls include TV personality Caitlyn Jenner, radio talk show host Larry Elder, and California State Representative Kevin Kiley. Time for an upgrade. Apple will be showing off its latest devices at today's annual Apple event, which will be virtual again this year. Expected product announcements include the the iPhone 13 with updated cameras, the Apple Watch Series 7, and the AirPod 3. One of the biggest rumors is that Apple will be showing off a way for iPhones to send an emergency call or text even when there's no cell service available. The event can be streamed online from the Apple website or on YouTube at 1 p.m. Eastern. Have a great day, everybody. I'll see you back tomorrow morning. This is a Recount Daily Pod, a podcast from The Recount and iHeartRadio. Our thanks to J.C. Hendrickson for being on the show. And if you like this episode, I hope you'll subscribe to The Recount Daily Pod and leave us a rating on the Apple Podcast app. I'm your host, Rena Ninen.